Hi, this week we're going to talk about A Diary of a Country Priest. This goes along with my chapter on the contemplative and active life and how those two things go together. And I have with me Chris Smith, who is the editor and founder of Inglewood Review of Books. So, Chris, welcome. Do you want to add anything to your bio so people know you?
Thanks, Jessica, for having me. Just really quickly, I'm part of the Englewood Christian Church community here in the urban Near East Side of Indianapolis. So that's kind of important to a lot of the work that I do with the ERB and a lot of the other writing and speaking that I do.
Yeah, I mean, Inglewood Review of Books just filled a huge gap, especially for all of us who are in love with books and culture. And you just kind of stepped in. I know you had started before, but you really stepped in and supplied a need for the church. So I'm appreciative of what you do.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I think there was just some really good, maybe even providential timing to kind of our history over the last, we started in 2008, so
Wow.
over a dozen years now.
Yeah, wow, that's fantastic. Well, congrats on that. I hope more people after this interview will go and follow Inglewood and hopefully
Well, I
pay.
hope so too. Thanks.
Yeah, that'd be great. So tell me about Diary of a Country Priest. When did you come to read this novel?
So I probably read it for the first time right after college.
Oh, wow.
There was a time period because I was during college, I didn't read much outside of what I had to do for classwork, and I didn't I took honors classes, but other than that, I didn't take a lot of literature classes. I was a math and computer science major, which is kind of odd twist to where I've ended up now, but yeah, so there was a period of time in the couple of years after I graduated from college that I was just learning a lot of things and just kind of reading a lot of kind of faith-oriented things, probably a lot of church history, but also certainly some kind of classics in the Christian tradition. And Diary of a Country Priest was one of those that I read
Yeah.
for the first time then. And actually, probably. So I just reread it this past month after you invited me to have this conversation. And I don't know that I had read it at all in between.
Oh, wow.
So it's been a while. And yeah, it was definitely a different experience reading it now and kind of reading it, we'll say 25 years ago.
Can I ask how you found it though? Because it's a rather obscure text, I think, for most people. So, when I first showed a draft of The Scandal of Holiness to one of my friends, she's like, "Did you pick the most obscure books you could think of?" She hadn't heard of a single one of the books in The Scandal of Holiness. So it's got like a
Oh,
cult following, but it doesn't have like a major popular following.
wow. Yeah, I mean, and I don't honestly remember exactly how I found it. I know that I was reading a lot of things related to kind of the contemplative tradition in those first couple of years after college. Richard Foster's Celebration of Discipline, in some ways, kind of became its own curriculum for me. Because I pretty much tried to read every book that he mentioned in that book, which was a wonderful sort of introduction to the Christian tradition and church history, because he is a master of kind of that sort of history. So I can't remember if this novel was mentioned there or it was mentioned in another book that I read because it was mentioned by Foster. I can't remember, but it was something along those lines.
You know, when I first found it because of Image, do you remember when Image put out that list of, the 100 books Christians should read? Do you remember that? It was on.
Yeah, that was a while back. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was at least 30 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. Farther.
Yeah, it was a long time ago. But I remember that became like a curriculum outside of my college curriculum that I wanted to follow. Like I wanted to go through every single one of those books. So for me,
Sure.
I bought it, but then it sat on my shelf forever. Like I got this used copy. I actually have like two used copies and it just sat there and I never paid attention to it. And then when I finally got around to reading it, it was like, oh wow, why hadn't I read this earlier?
Sure. Yeah, it's there's definitely good reasons that it's a classic.
Yeah.
I think though, I mean, I will be honest, I wasn't quite it was a little I was a little less comfortable with it now than I was 25 years ago. I could certainly see things that I can see why I appreciated it,
Yeah.
but kind of being in a little bit different place faith-wise, there were some things that just kind of made me raise my eyebrows a little bit.
Yeah, so tell me what those were. Like, what drew you to it, or like, what was your impression 25 years ago, and then now, what are your hesitancies?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. In some senses, for those that haven't read the novel, in some senses, it's kind of drawing upon for what might be called kind of the literary history of historic individualism. Kind of this, I mean, you have this priest who is a saint of sorts in kind of the traditional sense in which that's understood, and his parish is much less than kind to him, but yet, and he's, as you find out over the course of the novel, he's practically dying of cancer. And so he's got a lot of things kind of stacked up against him, but is able to kind of find peace and a pretty deep relationship with God in spite of those things. So that's kind of what I mean by kind of the historic, our heroic individualism. I mean, again, it's kind of about the same time that Gatsby came out. I mean, just a lot of the literature of that era. I mean, Camus isn't, The Stranger isn't exactly historic individualism, our heroic individualism, but it's definitely very individualistic and kind of fatalistic. I'm less comfortable with that today, and particularly in the ways that we think of saints. Mm-hmm. I think the more I read church history and the more I read biographies of saints, they're always kind of products of their times and communities to which they belong. Mm-hmm. I think one of the big things in kind of the way that I think about things and the way the writing that I do is the importance of the local communities. And of course, in this novel, the local community is kind of derided. They're just kind of they're derided for their boredom, and they're kind of the impediment to the faith of this priest. And there's like this passage, maybe about a third of the way through the book, where he's talking about prayer. It's kind of a pretty significant and really eloquent passage where he's kind of describing prayer. And he talks about kind of the way that in prayer, the individual is connected to the universal humanity through Christ. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that, but I think what's missing is kind of an erasure of the local community, particularly the local congregation, in that sort of depiction of prayer and praying with and alongside those who daily form us. Anyway, it's that sort of thing that I'm a little less comfortable with. Mm-hmm. Kind of thinking of, I don't read a lot of fiction, honestly. I'm kind of more of a nonfiction sort of person, and even kind of literary. In the literary world, but I'll read a lot more essays and creative memoirs and so forth. But one of the novels that I've really appreciated recently is James McBride's Deacon King Kong. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that really kind of strikes me about that is just the really kind of crucial role that the community plays. It's a novel about New York in the early 70s, but the I won't give too much of that away, and we're not here to talk about that. I think that that's the sort of fiction that is really that I'm drawn toward, where they're particularly where communities, families, mm-hmm. Neighborhoods, churches, maybe even in some cases, almost become characters in themselves. Mm-hmm. There was a novel a few years back, Angela Flournoy's The Turner House, and the family in that book is it's a novel about a particular family in Detroit, also kind of in the early to mid 70s, I think. But the family becomes kind of a character of itself, and I find that sort of thing really fascinating. So anyway, the social dynamics were a little less meaningful to me, and kind of a little more unsettling to me than kind of when I read it the first time. I think that was that's the major difference.
For me, it's fascinating to hear you say that, because of course, one of the trajectories of my book, I mean, the second chapter is the idea that you can't be a saint by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Necessity of the community is definitely emphasized. So when I'm reading this novel, my lens is so much on the priest and his connections to other people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when he starts, he's almost, like you said, derisive. Like he begins, you said boredom. I don't remember exactly what he says, but he sounds so negative. He's like, mine is a parish like all the rest. They're all alike. Right?
So yeah.
His generality in which sure. He doesn't see where he is. And he even says like, my parish is bored stiff. No other word for it. Like so many others. And he has like this negative temperament. And mm-hmm. even, like if he died right there, there would be nothing sanctifying like about his life. But what's interesting is when he learns to engage with the people, like even Cure de Torcy, he starts having this relationship with his failed relationship with the doctor in town, right? The conversation he has with the madame, you know, sure. completely changes her. And it just seems like all these people, these characters, granted, none of them are really sanctifying. I mean, none of them are holy. He does stand out as like the, I think he's supposed to stand out as the holiest character. You might disagree
right.
is, but like, that's what he's supposed to do. And yet the beginning to the end, you see the move to sanctification happens by the necessity of stepping outside of his perspective. Like in some sense, these relationships are doing as much work as prayer is doing to transform him. Do you see that? Or
no? Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. I can see the sort of transformation that happens.
Because I mean, imagine like I'm giving so much away, I can't help it. But like when you get to the end of the novel and he's like returning to his old friend, the other priest, you
sure.
can imagine if the guy who had started the novel with us seen his old friend back when he was so condescending, he wouldn't have been able to love his friend. There just wasn't a lot of charity in him. And I feel like one of the things that happens over the course of the novel is just watching this guy have to go from a loner, essentially, to understanding that everyone is imperfect, including himself, right? I mean, I don't know. I feel like he has to change his perspective on himself and other people.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I definitely think that there's an element of transformation there. But again, it's personal. personal transformation. It's a product of the kind of time and place in which it was written.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that today, almost a century later, not quite a century later, 90 years later or whatever, I'm much more interested in kind of a deeper kind of social dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
I think the modern trajectory of individualism hasn't served us well.
Right.
There is personal transformation. And I think that's, why this book has become the sort of, albeit not as well known maybe as it should be, mm-hmm. as we kind of discussed earlier, but the sort of classic that it is that, even this kind of hardened priest can be transformed, and I mean even the madame is transformed pretty powerfully. That's kind of one of the climax of the novel, so to speak. Prayer plays a kind of a key role in her transformation, kind of her inability to pray.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the grief that she suffered in losing her son, and kind of alienation from her other members of her family,
mm-hmm.
Just kind of frustrated with God or whatever, but kind of through her friendship and conversations with our friend the priest, kind of experiences her own sort of transformation.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I enjoy the novel so much and keep returning to it, because, you know, my first book was on, you know, the demonic authority of the autonomous self. So I'm, you know, I'm very antagonistic to the idea, right? Of like the lone sure. individual, you know, that kind of hero story I'm not into. What I appreciated about this, even though it's a diary, is it's showing the necessity of that inwardness, the relationship with God, the contemplative life as the source by which we are then able to enter the active life in the community, right? And I think some of the problems that I see, especially as a teacher, you know, I've had classes start where I'll give them each an index card and I'll say, like, write down what is wrong with the world, you know? And they'll inevitably, somebody says, like, well, what's wrong with it is that we're in here discussing philosophy and we're not. And that's what always happens. And so I start saying, well, what do you want to do to change the world? Why? Why is that the best solution? What? And this drive towards activity apart from prayerful contemplation, I feel like you don't see the problems that you know, we're not trying to see with God's eyes. We're trying to see with our own eyes and fix things according to our own measures. And I think that's what I love about watching his transformation, is he goes from someone who is just lambasting his community for being bored and selfish to someone who has to, at that moment with the madame, see himself, I am just an instrument like that poker that you're using with the fire. I am just that. And God now needs to do something in your life through me. Right? To me, that's so powerful about the novel.
Sure. Yeah, no, I'm sympathetic to that. I've made that same argument in a lot of other contexts, the problem of just kind of quote unquote just doing something, that sort of activism without kind of a rootedness in Christ or in the Christian tradition or in something, maybe for others kind of outside of the Christian faith, it's would talk about that rootedness in other ways. Mm-hmm. But I guess what I don't see, and again, it's just maybe outside the scope of what Bernanos was trying to do, is, I mean, you don't really see the effects of, I mean, you see people persons transformed, but you don't see, that's not to say that there might not have been some kind of social change that happens as a result of this personal transformation, but he kind of leaves it at merely personal transformation. So I guess that's something that doesn't completely sit well with me as a reader. But again, like I said, it's probably outside the scope of what he was trying to do. It's part of it is kind of me in the place, being in a different place than I was when I first read the novel years ago.
Well, and Bernanos, I mean, you're right in the sense that the place doesn't take on a character. He was writing this where, didn't he have to, I don't know, I'm not a Bernanos scholar. So I remember vaguely from reading his biography, but I feel like he had to leave. He had to be, I mean, he essentially chose to be exiled, so he wasn't in France during the occupation because the Nazis were moving into France. And so he left to go write this novel. Is that right? I mean, I feel like he's trying to like imagine France as he knows it, and yet he's not there in the midst of the turmoil.
I think that's right. And then he comes back at some point, but I think it's after he's written the novel. I could be wrong about that.
You could see that, like, that sense of place, you know, in some ways you're right on that, like the place is abstracted from him that he's trying to imagine and get back to. And it's a place that's not even going to exist anymore because of the war.
Right? All right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a place that's going to be demolished and changed. And he's writing about it as it used to be. I mean, there's almost like this sense of nostalgia, even in the approach to that parish.
Sure.
Right. But I was thinking when you were talking about not liking the lone character, are you a Wendell Berry fan?
I am.
Okay.
I am. I'm more so his essays and poetry
Okay.
Than his fiction.
I was going to ask about Jaber Crow, because like that to me is one of the reasons I don't like Jaber Crow, but I actually like this novel. Do you see the connections or no?
Yes, say a little, just a little bit more.
So, Jaber Crow, I mean, he's so inward, and like even his relationships are inactive, right? Like he chooses not to be active because he thinks it's almost like it's supposed to be this like Sydney Carton kind of relationship with the figure that he loves, where you sacrifice yourself loving that person platonically forever. And in that sense, it's so disconnected and abstracted and only about what's going on internally for Jaber that I just struggle to connect
Sure.
the novel. It, whereas for this, I can feel his passion for the characters, like his sense of pity, his emotional ties to them. I mean, he really does start hurting over them. Right? He like, I don't know, the visceral responses he has to other people in the community just feel so much more charged to me than
Sure, yeah, that makes sense. That kind of contrast to Jaber Crow. I think part of it too, again, this is just kind of personal aesthetics, but the kind of diary sort of genre, where you're kind of seeing and hearing kind of all his personal thoughts, it didn't, again, it seems like a lot of hand-wringing. So it's not, again, I mean, it works for what Bernanos is trying to do. But again, it's not necessarily my cup of tea, I guess.
Yeah, but then and then at the end though, again going back out to the community, like it doesn't end in his voice, it
Oh,
ends
yeah, right there.
outside of him, right? Like it gives you this like epistolary add-on that says, this is my perspective on him that's going out into the world. I mean, it's a real opening, like grace is everywhere. It ends with this outward turn from this priest. So you're right, it definitely has that, kind of insulated feel to it aesthetically until the end.
Until the end, yeah.
Right? Then
Yeah,
what?
and of course that line is a wonderful one, and one that's kind of become the kind of almost tagline for the novel. Even folks that haven't read the novel may be familiar with kind of that. Of course the novel was made into a pretty significant movie.
Have you seen it? I haven't seen
And I
it.
haven't actually.
Okay.
But I kind of read a number of reviews and summaries of the movie as I was trying to kind of refresh my memory of but yeah, so some folks may be familiar with the story or that last line, which I think there's a slight variation in kind of how that's presented in the movie, which I think is mostly just a different translation.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think of the way that it ends? Grace is everywhere.
I mean, it's hard to argue with. It's something that we all need to be reminded of, that the grace of God, I mean, what the Calvinists would call the common grace, I mean, is everywhere. It meets us in the most mundane of interactions, daily interactions. But on the other hand, the flip side of that is that in some senses, because grace is everywhere, and it's encapsulated that way, you kind of in some senses lose the particularity of it. I mean, grace is in this relationship or this encounter or this sunrise or so yeah, I mean, I mean it's hard to argue with that idea from the Christian theological tradition, but also I think we mean it's I mean something that I say a lot is, I mean, if it's everybody's job, then it's nobody's job. If grace is everywhere, then we can perhaps it becomes too easy to take it for granted, I guess is another way of saying that. And it really I mean, how do we keep that in the forefront of our minds? That even in the face of cancer and death, in our character, our priest's case, here, that he's able to find the grace of God. I think that's one of the striking things for me about this novel that was striking before and continues to be pretty powerful for me is the way that he faces his own death. Mm-hmm. I had a couple friends that were a couple married both died of cancer in their late 20s, but were powerful witnesses of the hope of God's kingdom in the way that they faced their very untimely deaths. So I was reminded of their story as the priest was the last half or so of the last chapter, where he's knowing that he's going to die and yet ending up, as we have said, proclaiming that grace is everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's definitely not a romanticized ending when you think about it in that perspective. It's
oh no.
Like he says, Lord, could I have loved it all so much? I mean, there isn't a sense that he's disdaining the world. There's not a sense that he's, he's fearing death, but that's not the only thing that he's experiencing, right? There's just so much realism that grants him that, I think, final revelation that grace is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
Well, as we close, I know that for me, the book is hopefully going to introduce churches to the necessity of reading, but that's something you've done a ton of work on. Yes. I mean, do you have visual aids? Do you have your books to show people?
Probably somewhere. Oh, here we go.
I didn't ask you that ahead of time, but I thought you should show people your books because if they
this is the one that is most directly related to what you were describing. The tradition of individualism has shaped how we understand reading and the ways that we approach reading, that in a lot of ways it is a very personal act, but it doesn't have to be a private act.
Mm-hmm.
And I see reading and conversation as intertwined sorts of acts. Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful that, of course, in churches, we're always reading scripture together. And that may be one of the best sort of examples that we have of reading together in the present age. But conversation, I think, along with that, where are the ways that we're able to bring ourselves and our interpretations and experiences into conversation with the text and others' experiences and others' interpretations, and how do we find the grace that is everywhere.
Yep.
Amidst particularly situations in which there's differing sorts of interpretations and understandings and experiences. I believe that that we do find grace by being willing to have that sort of vulnerability where we over time and with trust, those things are very, very important, but to be able to share ourselves and to know and be known.
Yeah.
And I think there's something powerfully transformative about that.
Right.
And as you said, reading is an important part of that. Reading, even apart from conversation, reading is a way to open us up to the experiences of others. And hopefully if we do that well, hopefully that sort of opening up carries over into our openness to hear and receive the gift of others' experience. I think that I'm hopeful that churches really take reading seriously. There's at least minimal ways that congregations do that already, but just to be a little bit more mindful about that, and also to find new ways, because part of the work of reading scripture is interpreting scripture, and that's opens us up to all kinds of other sorts of reading, from things that help us understand the text itself, but also ways that we give us imagination for how we embody a particular text, how we live into that in our particular, all the sorts of particularities of the times and places where we are.
Yeah.
So So yeah, I'm excited about your book, and are really, really enthusiastic about a fellow author that's kind of really encouraging the practice of reading and taking that seriously, and as something that really can transform us as persons and as communities.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Chris. I appreciate it. You just gave the best pitch I think you could. Well. So thank you.